The finest basketball plays can look like poetry in motion, which means the most gorgeous arc of a basketball pass might resemble this.
When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate.
Lines from Shakespeare, one of many sonnets first published 400 years ago today. The sonnets have inspired many debates, including this question: did Shakespeare want them published? Here's NPR's Lynn Neary.
What does this?
Well, you can tell everybody down in Old Frisco, tell them Tiny Montgomery says hello,
have in common with this?
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date.
Well, Clinton Halen thinks quite a lot. When Halen was researching a book on bootleggers in the music industry during the 1970s, he discovered that a lot of Shakespeare's plays had been bootlegged as well, and that got him curious about the sonnets. The result is his new book, So Long as Men Can Breathe, the story of how the sonnets came to be published and what happened to them over the years. To begin with, Halen says, Bob Dylan's basement tapes and Shakespeare's sonnets were never intended for a wide audience.
Essentially, in both cases, they were killing time and at the same time dealing with huge personal issues in a private way, which they never conceived of coming out publicly.
So how did the sonnets come to be published 400 years ago? As Halen tells it, Elizabethan publishing was a murky, anarchic business. It wasn't hard for an enterprising publisher to get his hands on a manuscript without the author's approval. Halen believes Thomas Thorpe, the man who published the sonnets, did just that.
This was a man who lived on the very periphery of the London publishing world, who struggled to make ends meet, who was constantly in trouble with the stationer's company for publishing books that flagrantly breached the copyright of other publishers. You know, this is somebody who, if he got his hands on Shakespeare's sonnets, must have done so in some kind of underhanded, slightly questionable way.
But why was Shakespeare so intent on keeping the sonnets private? That gets to some of the most controversial questions about the sonnets. Most of the poems are addressed to a fair youth, and his identity has been the source of endless academic debate. Halen believes it was William Herbert, Earl of Pembroke.
He had a fairly wild youth. He was known to play both sides of the field. He was a poet in his own right. He was certainly a lusty young lord. So a lot of the details that are in the sonnets imply that type of personality is the fair youth.
And here's the tricky part, the part that those of us who have not been following the academic debates over the years may not have known. Many scholars believe the sonnets are autobiographical, which means the sonnets addressed to the fair youth are Shakespeare's expressions of love for him. They point to poems like Sonnet 20 as an example. Here's an excerpt.
And for a woman wert thou first created, till nature, as she wrought thee, fell a-doting, and by addition me of thee defeated, by adding one thing to my purpose, nothing. But since she pricked thee out for woman's pleasure, mine be thy love, and thy love's use their treasure.
It is for this reason, says Halen, that Shakespeare never wanted the sonnets published and may even have sought to have the Thorpe edition suppressed.
If the sonnets are interpreted in what I think these days would be considered a fairly normal way, which is that they're about a homosexual affair with a peer, he was committing several criminal offences. I mean, it would have been extremely socially sensitive for him to have any kind of scandal that involved him and a male peer.
The highly personal nature of the poem, says Halen, was a radical departure for an Elizabethan writer. In the sonnets, Shakespeare revealed himself far more than he ever did in the plays.
Wordsworth talked about these sonnets as the key that unlocked his heart. And that might be a slight overstatement, but it's only a slight one. I mean, they are an insight into who the man was, and it's likely to be the closest we're ever going to get to the mind of William Shakespeare.
The Thorpe edition of the sonnets disappeared and did not resurface for almost 200 years. There are only 13 copies of the original publication left, but nothing could diminish the emotional power and popularity of some of the greatest love poems ever written. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington. The author and journalist Carl Taro Greenfeld has lived in the shadow of autism. He doesn't suffer from the disease, but his only brother, Noah, is severely autistic, and that difficult fact of life penetrated every aspect of the Greenfeld home. In the 1970s, his father, Joshua Greenfeld, wrote a series of groundbreaking bestsellers about Noah's struggles. After that, there were magazine covers and television features. Noah became a national celebrity, and that shadow of autism, it grew. In a 1978 segment of the CBS program 60 Minutes, Dan Rather asked a young Carl Taro Greenfeld about life with his brother.
Do you ever wish that Noah were a normal brother?
Yeah, lots of times.
When do you find yourself wishing that?
I think we can take trips if he was normal. You know, we could do things a normal family could do. Like, right now we have to center our lives completely around him, but if he was normal, we wouldn't have to do that.
That was Carl Greenfeld at 13 years old. Today he's 44, and he's told his story in an unflinching book called Boy Alone, A Brother's Memoir.
Every teenager is ashamed of his family, of course. But why do I have to deal with this extra unwanted scrutiny brought on by having an autistic brother? The spitting, hair-pulling, screaming, tantruming younger brother who doesn't allow me to pretend for an instant that we're a normal family. As if having a Japanese mother and Jewish father is not enough. I become locally famous in my school for nothing more than having a retard brother.
Carl Taro Greenfeld acted out as a teenager, and he struggled with addiction into adulthood. He's also found success as a writer. He's happily married with two kids of his own. But the book makes clear that the shadow of autism is always there.
When you have a developmentally disabled person in your family, whether that's a child or I suppose people who have parents who have Alzheimer's and take them in, the sort of gravity of the family is just tilted disproportionately toward that person. And in my family, Noah became the center of everything almost as soon as I have a memory of myself. The memory is of worrying about Noah and the family worrying about Noah and people trying to figure out what to do with Noah. And early on, it's what's wrong with Noah? Why isn't Noah speaking? Why isn't Noah doing all the things he's supposed to do? And then later, the dilemma shifts to what are we going to do with Noah? We have to find a place for Noah. How are we going to take care of Noah? So the whole conversation in my family was very much, I feel like, 80% Noah, and then 20% probably the stuff everyone else talks about. So I was very much the less important sibling. But I don't look back on that with any kind of self-pity. It just was the reality of the situation.
You know, you say that you don't have pity when you look back, but you do write with a mixture of empathy and anger. You describe many times how beautiful Noah was, but you note that it was almost like a trick that he could use to seduce people, his caregivers, in some cases your parents, in some cases a psychiatrist that he was dealing with. And you describe him as someone who was gibbering, finger-twiddling, head-bobbing, spitting, and you use the word idiot more than once.
Well, it's not very politically correct, I guess, the term idiot. I think it's what society used to call people like Noah. And I think I use it in that more classical sense of the word idiot. But I pity Noah emotionally, but I don't pity him intellectually, because what has Noah been in my life but something of a burden? And what has he given me as a brother other than a sense that I have to worry about him and take care of him and going forward as my parents age and my father is in his 80s, my mother in her late 70s, ultimately won't the burden of Noah fall to me?
You know, Carl, a lot of people believe that people with special needs come into our life, and when they do, they are almost like a kind of gift, that they call upon individuals to reach for something inside themselves, to find their better self in order to live in the service of others. When you look back at your own life and you peel away the anger and the frustration that you felt, do you think that there were lessons that you took from that, or that people are able to take from living with someone who cannot function without the help of others?
I think we do learn compassion, and we learn a certain selflessness from Noah, but it's not a lesson that you take eagerly. It's literally crammed down your throat. I mean, Noah will force you to become, to be more patient. Noah will force you to be selfless because you don't have a choice. So it's a lesson that I never felt like I was grateful for, because it was just, it's the kind of lesson you learn. If you're hit by a car, you learn to be afraid of cars. And I feel a little bit like that's the lesson that I got from Noah. And I know that I should try to find whatever redemption that, you know, there is in Noah. But it starts with looking at Noah's own life and the hardships that he's had and what he's gone through. And it's hard for me to say, well, I'm learning so much from this, and that makes it okay, because I look at Noah and think it's not okay. I mean, Noah's a shattered mess.
What message do you want people to take from this book?
Well, there's two things. There's the idea of that families are all different, and that each of us, or that many of us, have siblings or relatives who we don't always know how to act toward, or how responsible we have to be for them. And all I'm trying to say in talking about my own childhood is that here's what I did. Here's how I got through it. And here's a little bit of what I learned. There's another educational point here, which is that idea that there are a lot of adult autistics out there in the world, and there's going to be more if we believe the CDC diagnostic numbers of 1 in 150, those prevalence numbers. And I don't think we're ready for them as a society, and I don't think we've really begun to focus our attention to what this is going to mean in terms of long-term care and lifespan issues. And part of the great success of the marketing of autism in the last decade has been this idea of autism as a childhood condition. Well, all these children are going to grow up. Noah was a beautiful boy once, and he grew up. And I don't feel like we're really looking at the implications of that. And I think that's where this conversation, I think, is going to be of some utility, because we're all going to be facing this challenge. How responsible am I? How much am I supposed to do? When am I supposed to take over? And that's a conversation that I think needs to happen on a societal level and maybe on a family level.
Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us about this.
Thank you.
Carl Taro Greenfeld. His book is called Boy Alone, A Brother's Memoir. For more on the book, including an excerpt, visit our website, npr.org. Writer Jeffrey Eugenides knows something about playing around with language. He's the author of two acclaimed novels, Middlesex and The Virgin Suicides. In our series, You Must Read This, authors talk about a book they love. Jeffrey Eugenides recommends a 20th century classic.
There's a little thing I do when I can't write. When I'm feeling sleepy, when my head's in a fog, I reach across my desk, digging under the piles of unanswered mail, to unearth my copy of Herzog by Saul Bellow. And then I open the book, anywhere, and read a paragraph. It always works. Right away, I'm restored to full alertness and clarity. Style in literature has gone out of style. People think it's just ornament, but it's not. The work that goes into a writer's style, the choices that are taken, the clichés that are chucked, represent a refining of thought and feeling into their purest, most intelligent, most moral form. Of course, there is a danger with a great stylist, that the sentences will outclass what the sentences are about. Not with Bellow. Bellow gets the mix between form and content about as right as possible. His sentences pack maximum sensual, emotional, and intellectual information into minimum space, all the while generating an involving, deeply moving story. Published in 1964, Herzog is about a middle-aged college professor in the midst of an emotional crisis who begins writing letters. He had fallen under a spell, Bellow writes, and was writing letters to everyone under the sun. Hidden in the country, he wrote endlessly, fanatically, to the newspapers, to people in public, to friends and relatives, and at last to the dead, his own obscure dead, and finally the famous dead. The book zooms off from there, Herzog goes from New York to Martha's Vineyard to Chicago to the Berkshires, penning his funny, serious, brilliant, self-lacerating, accusatory letters, each one acting like a new screen in a hypertext novel that opens an entirely different piece of his life. His immigrant childhood in Montreal, his indomitable ex-wife Madeline, his numerous lady friends, his free-falling career, his pain at losing his daughter in divorce. Bellow, the supreme realist, discovered in Herzog a new form, the self-reflexive epistolary novel, without any of the obscurantism or self-preening of so-called experimental novels. Herzog worried that his frantic letter-writing meant he was out of his mind, but in the last 45 years, his predicament has become pretty much universal. Herzog's life resembles the way we live now, where we're forever sending off emails and texts, fielding cell phone calls, where we're no longer any one place, but everywhere and nowhere at once. Our life in shards, randomly returning. The mark of a truly original work of art is that it gets truer the older it is. The impulse here is to quote, "Every single part of Herzog teems with jokes, apercues, deep thinker riffs, little genius moves every other sentence. The impulse is to read the entire book out loud. But I've only got a few moments here. Time to make the pitch, but not go 9 innings. So, let me say this. If you're in the market for a safe neuroenhancer, something to break you out of your foggy-headedness, a pill more powerful than Adderall or Provigil, with no side effects other than an uptick in pleasure, then pick up Herzog and open it anywhere and read."
Jeffrey Eugenides, he's the author of the novels Middlesex and The Virgin Suicides. He was recommending the novel Herzog by Saul Bellow.
Long before some best-selling memoirs were unmasked as heavily embellished fictions, the writer Clive James embraced the concept. In the preface to his first memoir, written 30 years ago, he proclaimed, "Most first novels are disguised autobiographies. This autobiography is a disguised novel." Clive James was, and still is, among London's best-known wits, dashing off literary criticism and satirical verse, writing novels and appearing on TV. And now his autobiography, Unreliable Memoirs, has been re-released in America. Fueled by a deep appreciation for the absurd, he recounts his youth in an unpromising post-war suburb of Sydney, Australia. It's a boy's life filled with death-defying escapades, first love, self-abuse, and the casual cruelty of children. Among his many hair-raising adventures, engineering a line of go-karts down a surprisingly steep hill into an angry woman's flower garden.
And the way I wrote all this down, it's got the action and the timing of a Tom and Jerry cartoon. In real life, it's not quite like that. So you could say the events are edited for action.
Still, Clive James' story is rooted in a tragedy. At the end of World War II, after surviving years in a Japanese war camp, when his family thought he was finally safe, Clive James' father was killed when the plane carrying him home crashed.
That was the cruelty of it, of course. My mother had waited all that time. Then she'd received notification he was alive after all. Then all that was taken away from her when the plane crashed on the way back. But I didn't know any of that. You know, five-year-old boys know nothing. And I just didn't know what was going on. I just knew that my mother was unhappy. And that's always unsettling.
Well, as it turns out, she was in some senses unprepared to be... to take you on as a project.
It's quite remarkable that I did not become first of a delinquent, then a felon, and then a prisoner, because I had absolutely no qualifications for ordinary life, except luckily I had a certain gift for the English language, a knack. But without that, I would have been a real problem.
You start out with a propensity to have near-death experiences.
Yes. For example, if there was a broken milk bottle somewhere in the area, I would find it with my foot. It was just uncanny. And I was always... coming home, or more often being brought home, bleeding. And my mother spent a lot of time just repairing me.
Your mother did make you a little superhero costume at one at one point.
I was a big fan of the movie serials. We used to go to the movies every Saturday, all my bunch of kids, and you'd see 16 cartoons and about half a dozen episodes from different serials, The Lost City of the Jungle, Batman. I wanted to be one of these people, superheroes. And I invented a character of myself called the Flash of Lightning. And in this outfit, when dusk fell, only after dark, I would suddenly appear silhouetted against the stars on the back fence, ready for my progress from yard to yard along the street. But I almost killed myself then too, because I was coming home one night quite late and climbing our back fence, and I slipped and fell, and the little piece of rope that held my cape around my neck caught in the top paling of the fence, and I was hanging there strangling. And that would have been the end of me if the rope hadn't broken and I hadn't fallen straight into the cabbage patch. But that was the biggest adventure the Flash of Lightning ever had. He hung up his cape after that, but he's still in my mind. I'm still him, in a way.
There's also a moment when you're a young adolescent. You describe yourself as a kid who hasn't matured as fast as the other boys around you, who loves girls, but, you know, they don't even glance your way because you're going to be one that doesn't shoot up.
No, I never did shoot up. No, I inched up.
But it's a very,
very typical scene for someone my age in that position, or 13 or 14, where you're actually envious of kids whose faces are weeping with acne because your face isn't. Yeah? But no, I tried to put in all the weaknesses and indeed the horrors of being a little boy. There were very few memoirs that confess to the terrible things that little boys get up to, especially when they're together and in competition. I tried to put all that in. I had noticed that one of my favorite writers about childhood, an American, Booth Tarkington, the young boy goes out on adventures too, and he's the terror of the neighborhood and so on, but he's very, very clean. It's basically sanitized. And I didn't want my book to be that. I wanted to bring in the realities. Mm. Little boys are disgusting little people. They should be avoided if possible, or disciplined harshly.
But one thing you found, and it served you, as it turns out, all of your life, which is you figured out and had a knack for it very young, as a young adolescent, that you could entertain people.
Telling stories was crucial to my existence and indeed to my survival. I was actually the kind of boy who was born to be picked on. I was snotty, know-it-all, and I was ganged up on and chased and ragged until I hit on the scheme, when I was being chased, of suddenly sitting down and organizing a discussion group and telling stories. And I would tell very tall stories. I told stories about my wartime service. Strangely enough, I was always fighting with Rommel in the Africa Corps because the wrong side seemed more glamorous. They were real fictions, the stories I told. But as long as I could keep the audience entertained, they wouldn't attack me. And I suppose that basic impulse worked with me all the way through show business.
Just to circle back in a way to the person who loomed quite large in your life is your mom.
Yes.
And she was, by your description, hopefully not entirely accurate, your mother was long-suffering.
She had a lot to put up with from my behavior and also from history, from circumstances. It was a cruel deprivation, my father being taken from her when she thought that he was safe. And life was hard, and she was very, very diligent, very honest. She had all the moral qualities, and she was always there, but she didn't really quite understand what I did next, because neither did I. The fact that I would go on from school to university and become some kind of artist or writer, all that was quite strange to her. She didn't have that kind of background. So she didn't really get what I was going to do next. And that went on like that all my life. And finally, when the Sydney University gave me an honorary doctorate, almost the last year of her life, and I got her brought in from the nursing home in a limousine, and she was there in the hall along with all the graduates. And finally, I walked towards her, magnificent in my ermine cap and my flowing robes. The Flash of Lightning rides again, you know? And the look in her eyes, I knew exactly what she was thinking. She was thinking, at last, he's got his qualifications. He's safe.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're too kind.
And you can read an excerpt of Clive James' Unreliable Memoirs at our website, npr.org.